All that work, and I'm afraid that my slides aren't nearly so creative as Professor Fisher's, but in any event, again, Wendy Seltzer with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and following up on Professor Fisher's excellent high-level description of what happens when we're trying to work with the production of non-rivalrous, non-excludable goods, and specifically music. I'm going to talk briefly about EFF's sort of ground-level view of the music file-sharing situation, and then discuss the different kind of alternative that we're proposing, which is the voluntary collective license. It shares many of the structural elements that Professor Fisher described as supporting a compulsory license, with the key difference that the participants do so voluntarily of their own accord without government coercion. So where are we today? The recording industry is suing its music fans, and when it does that, fans suffer, music suffers, and the internet suffers. They're suing children. Everybody in the United States read the story of the 12-year-old living in public housing who was one of the first round targets of the music industry's lawsuits against file sharers. They've gone after students who had the audacity to develop search programs for MP3 files on computers, on shared network segments in their college dorm rooms, and to trade some of those files themselves. They've been suing the innovators, the people behind Napster One and MP3.com, all the way down through Kazaa, Morpheus, Grokster, Audio Galaxy. They're trying to tell anyone who gets involved with this technology that this is a dangerous space, that this is a tainted space that they dare not deal with as a technological matter, because the recording industry will sue and try to hold them contributorily liable or vicariously liable for the exchange of unauthorized use of copyrighted works by the users of these systems. EFF is defending Streamcast Networks, the makers of the Morpheus file sharing software, in one of these lawsuits that we've won in the court below, is currently on appeal in the Ninth Circuit. We're expecting a decision any time now, but even to get to that point would have been tremendously expensive without pro bono counsel, was tremendously expensive even with pro bono counsel, and is chilling the development of software in this space. The industry is threatening universities that because students are engaged in file sharing on campus, if universities don't turn over the names of those students, the recording industries will come after them. It's threatening ISPs with the same sorts of subpoenas and demands. And it's threatening the structure of the internet itself, the openness that we all have come to love for its open extensibility and for the options it gives us to build anything we want in a peer-to-peer fashion to communicate with others on the net. The industries have been lobbying, as we've seen and heard in many of the other earlier discussions. They've already gotten copyright extension. They've gotten WIPO internet treaties, which in the United States give us the DMCA and technological protection measures that limit what we can do with media that we purchase or media that we lawfully obtain. They've given us technology mandates and broadcast flags that now tell us that every device in the United States that we buy capable of receiving high-definition television will have to have a government and industry-designed flag recognition module. No longer can we build it ourselves or design it ourselves around open standards, but we have to comply with the broadcast flag that will say, do not copy, and we'll be obliged not to copy and not to give ourselves the beautiful high-definition outputs that were supposed to be the promise of HDTV. They've given us, in the United States, lobbying for the Pirate Act, which civil and criminal penalties for copyright infringement that would put the Justice Department into the position of taking up lawsuits on behalf of copyright holders who are feeling a little bit of public pressure against these lawsuits that they've been launching themselves. And this lobbying activity is one of the reasons that we're a bit nervous about the compulsory licensing, government-organized solutions, because the same industries who have been lobbying for these draconian laws are the industries who would be lobbying very strongly in whatever compulsory license system were adapted. So the theoretical compulsory license system, we feel, looks rather different from the actual compulsory license we would be likely to get after the recording industry and Hollywood had exerted their pressure on it. So all of this suing, threatening, and lobbying is chilling activity on the internet. It's chilling software development. It's chilling the freedom of speech and connectivity that made the internet such a wonderful medium so far, threatening to close that down, get into the architecture itself, because if these industries have their way, they will make it impossible, legally and technically, for us to continue developing as we have. And for what? Well, in the United States, the balance sheet looks about 60 million music fans sharing online with peer-to-peer systems, and despite the waves of lawsuits, that number has stayed fairly constant. It dips a bit when a new wave of lawsuits is announced, and then it picks up again in different file-sharing networks. So those who used Kazaa might see that many lawsuits are being launched against Kazaa, but that doesn't necessarily knock them out of file sharing. It just moves them from Kazaa to Nutella, or Kazaa to eDonkey, and leaves them continuing to file share, continuing to engage in this activity. So far, the recording industry has launched about 3,000 lawsuits against individuals in the United States, and recently has begun launching similar lawsuits here in Europe. Well, what has that gotten us? It's gotten us $17 million, a little less in euros, given the way the US dollar has been performing lately, for the recording industry lawyers, and it's given us zero for the artists. None of what's being collected in these settlements is going to the artists. It's all going to pay the costs of more litigation. The artists aren't seeing a penny of additional revenue from this crackdown on file sharing. The lawsuits are spreading to Europe. Peer-to-peer is still around. We also say, though, that peer-to-peer is not the problem. Fans do a better job of distribution than record labels. You can find on peer-to-peer networks back catalog that's not available from any record store or any authorized distribution. You can find the selections that your friends have created that will introduce you to new artists based on their choices and not the choices of a Clear Channel over the radio or of a big box store like Walmart carrying a few standardized selections. I've heard that that's where more than 50% of people buy most of their music, in stores like Walmart. And even if you do live near a specialized record store that carries the kinds of collections you want, invariably you've gone in there and found that the CD you wanted wasn't on the shelf, all of the copies had sold out. Well, this is digital media. This is something that should be producible on demand. The fans can put that up there. Napster One was a bigger digital music library, a bigger music library than any record store or library has ever been able to assemble through so-called legitimate channels. On the other side, we see that DRM, digital rights management, as it tends to be called in the US, digital restriction management, as I prefer to call it, because it doesn't give the public rights. It tends to restrict what they can do. It hurts customers. It makes the product less useful. I was reading recently that the Beastie Boys' new album, which I've heard is quite good, comes with DRM that prevents you from ripping the CD to your computer, prevents you from burning from ripping the CD to make MP3s to put on your digital music player to burn an extra copy for the car. Nonetheless, that tracks from that CD are already appearing on the peer-to-peer networks. And if you ask the ordinary consumer which of those is a better product, well, it's very clear that the unencumbered MP3s you can find on the file-sharing networks are better, are more useful to you than the DRM-wrapped CD that you can buy legitimately in the store. But the Beastie Boys aren't offering you any way to buy that more useful alternative. And so customers who want to be legitimate have a choice. Do I pay for something worse or get for free something that's better? Hard to entice them away from peer-to-peer with worse alternatives. So if peer-to-peer isn't the problem is that artists aren't getting paid. It is the problem that we have a tremendously efficient, tremendously valuable library of music, and we don't have a way to compensate artists from it. How do we pay artists from peer-to-peer? And more specifically, how do we collect a pool of money and divide it fairly? And that's where we suggest that the voluntary collective license will work best. In short, we suggest copyright holders and artists form a collecting society, give fans an easy way to pay the right holders for file sharing, and once they've collected from the fans, divide that money fairly among the copyright holders and artists. We've seen this happen before. Broadcast radio was initially a pirate medium. Broadcasters thought they needed no rights to take recorded music and play it on the air. And when sued by copyright holders for the composers, who felt that, in fact, this was a violation of their exclusive copyright rights, the radio stations lost. But the answer wasn't to shut down the radio stations, and the answer wasn't to insist that the radio stations negotiate individually with every composer before playing a piece of music on the air. It was the composers got together in collecting societies, first ASCAP, later BMI and CSAC, and offered blanket licenses to the radio stations. Blanket license says, pay us a flat fee, which gives you license to use any of our music from any of our member composers at any time, in any way you want, with your own equipment, with your own ordering, with your own compilations, and simply report to us afterwards statistics that will let us distribute that music, the licensing fees among our members. The radio stations benefit. They once again get lawful access to music. The composers benefit. They get paid for the music that's performed. How does it work online? Well, we think it could work in a similar way. A collecting society offers a blanket license to file sharers for all non-commercial use and sharing of the music to which we hold license. And because of the entanglements of copyright, if you're not sure who owns all of the pieces, you give the users an indemnity. We won't sue you for anything in which our members claim rights. We also think that the market will do the best job at sorting out how users will pay. Users can pay on their own. They can pay a $5 fee each month directly to the collecting society. Some users might opt for that. Some users might find it easier to pay through ISPs. ISP would offer the super broadband, all-you-can-listen-to, paid-up license along with your broadband connection. That helps the ISPs sell faster connections to the internet. It helps the users to make the music feel free, and once again enables the sharing. Universities could bundle this fee into their student services fee. You could pay for it with software or hardware. It wouldn't matter how you had paid the license. If you had paid the monthly license, you would be entitled to use and share all of the collecting society's music. And I like to think of this as put yourself into the position of the CEO of the collecting society. you control the rights to a body of music, what's going to be the best way to get users to join up? How are you going to make it feel most open and free while at the same time inviting them to pay? Once the society has collected the money, divide that among artists and copyright holders, and how to determine what's being used. Well, digital rights management here could have some place. We could use watermarks in the music to determine what's being listened to and downloaded and played, and report that back. And since the idea of this kind of DRM is not to prevent you from listening to music, but simply to ensure that the artists whose music you're listening to get paid, there would be no incentive to remove that DRM. It's not stopping you from doing anything. It's simply rewarding the artists whose music you like. We don't need to invade user privacy to do this. There's statistical sampling, and Big Champagne already claims that it can sample what's being exchanged on the peer-to-peer networks. It reports to the music companies, although none of the music companies will admit to being a client of Big Champagne. At least some of them are using its services to find out in what markets their music is being played, and then to put songs on the radio that they might not otherwise have realized were hits. We might also have families volunteer Nielsen style to have more of their music listening uses monitored. Families do it, line up to volunteer as Nielsen families for the television monitoring on which millions of dollars of advertising are allocated. A combination of these methods with smart technological thinking about the kinds of hacking and trickery that are likely to go on will be a fair way to divide the music. And again, as the CEO of the Collecting Society, you want to be transparent and open about your methods. You want to give your members choices because there isn't necessarily just one collecting society, and if you're screwing things up and not offering a good deal to artists, another collecting society can come along and offer better terms and better options. So you want to think about what's going to be fair for the artists and for the public. Well, artists get paid from a system like this. Even independent artists can join. You don't have to join through a major record label. And even independent artists can get paid. If your music is being listened to, you get a piece of that pie. Fans get to choose the software and the music. They're not told you can listen to music only in encrypted AAC format and only on the iPod. They're not told you can burn two copies but not five. They're not told you can listen to this playlist, but not the one you'd really prefer to hear. They're told, go out, enjoy the music, go back and appreciate and create culture here. Software developers, once that legal cloud is lifted, get to develop the applications that will enable this music listening. They get to develop the better peer-to-peer applications, the ones that will help you to find if you liked this playlist, you might like this new artist whom you haven't heard before. They get to build those systems without being accused of aiding and abetting piracy. Instead, they're aiding and abetting increased consumption of music, and artists will appreciate these systems because the more exposure they get, again, the more money they get out of the pool. Government stays out of the way, except perhaps for some antitrust oversight if a collecting society gets too big and can coerce its members. That's the place where government should be regulating and keeping them in line. But keeping government out preserves flexibility. We don't know what the music industry will look like 10 years out. We don't know what the internet will look like 10 years out. If we legislate for what it looks like today, or by the time the legislators get through with it, what it looked like 5 years ago, we've locked ourselves into something that may not be the best for where we want to go 10 years out. Questions, will artists and labels join? Well, at the moment, I'll admit it's been difficult to get them to discuss these issues. They are, the major labels are still convinced that they will find some way of getting back to business as they know it. But independent artists are increasingly finding that the music industry doesn't work well for them and are starting to look at alternatives for distribution. If a critical mass of them can join up in offering these licenses, then that can help propel their greater adoption. After all, they're not making any money from peer-to-peer distribution right now. I think this offers them more money, a fairer deal for their fans, something that is clearly a step forward. Will fans pay? Well, if it feels free, if it feels like the cost of a couple of coffees, fans, I think, will pay. Fans appreciate the work that their artists are doing. They don't want to be ripping people off. And a system that offers them an easy way to pay for file sharing, as opposed to telling them the only thing you can buy is a CD wrapped up in a polycarbonate disc, I think they will pay. And if it's an easy payment like $5 a month, spread out among lots of easy, convenient ways to pay for it, I think that will work. Won't the collecting society charge too much is a question I've heard several times. Well, the collecting society is still competing with free. It's still competing with the fact that users can go onto the peer-to-peer systems and take the risk that they won't be caught, as nearly 60 million users are still doing after thousands of lawsuits. So if they charge $100 a month, they won't be getting very many people to pay up. They're not much better off than they were right now. The movie industry started off with similar pricing for videotapes. At first, they thought that videotapes would be kind of, they were selling priced for the rental shops, and they were selling $90 or $100 for a videotape. And people would rent a videotape, and they'd copy it. And that wasn't giving much revenue to the movie companies. When they brought the pricing down, $15 or $20 or $10, or you can go into Blockbuster and get a used video for $5, people started buying these things. And you notice when DVDs came out, they're all priced $5, $15, $20, maybe $40 for a special edition boxed set. But reasonable prices, and the consumers will pay. The movie industry is having banner years since the introduction of the DVD and reasonable pricing. How does this work internationally? Well, you've heard from a lot of the Creative Commons presentations about the differences in copyright law internationally. I think the collecting societies would be nationally based. Of course, foreign artists whose works were being shared could join those collecting societies and get their piece of the collected pie. And once established in one place, we think that this is a model that would be emulated elsewhere. Once it were shown that there was a better alternative to suing all the music fans, I think others would follow that model. What about other media? Well, it's been in the music industry that we've seen the greatest claims of a problem and the greatest attempts to crack down on the internet to solve that problem. And so that's why our proposal focuses principally on music And when other industries demonstrate a problem, or perhaps when other industries see something working for the music industry, they can move into something similar. So our options, we've got the suing, threatening, lobbying, and chilling on one side, or the voluntary collective license. We think the collective license looks like a much better way. Take those 60 million U.S. music fans and offer them a $5 a month music license. That gets us up to $3.6 billion for music that includes the artists, and that's more than the music industry's net revenue for a product that doesn't require them to do any extra work beyond what they're already doing. This is distribution that's costless to them. The fans do all of the work. Offers a better deal all around. So we ask, offer the you choose between the suing, threatening, lobbying, and chilling, or a pool of money, fair way to divide it, that makes peer-to-peer legal and preserves the open architecture of the internet. Thanks very much.